This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk about the efforts to recover antiquities stolen from museums in Iraq. But first, one of the great advantages the United States has in weaponry is its ability to destroy enemy tanks by hitting them with very lethal armor-piercing ammunition, sort of anti-tank bullets made from depleted uranium, or DU as it's called. Depleted uranium is the heavy metal that is left over when natural uranium is used to produce fuel for nuclear reactors. In the first Gulf War, about 320 tons of depleted uranium ammunition was fired. DU has also been used in Bosnia, Kosovo, Serbia, Montenegro, and most recently in Iraq. The Department of Defense says depleted uranium gives fighting forces a clear advantage in conflict. It pierces through armor and makes for strong armor itself. Iraqi tank shells have been known to bounce off American tanks that wear armor made of depleted uranium. The DoD says its studies of exposure of soldiers to shrapnel from the first Gulf War and the others have not shown soldiers to suffer long-term effects. Critics say that DU does represent a health hazard both to soldiers and to civilians on the battlefield. At worst, they claim it can cause cancer and other illnesses, and at best, the threat posed by DU is not known because the health effects have not been studied enough, they say. Earlier this month, the United Nations Environment Program recommended that a scientific assessment of sites targeted by DU weapons be conducted in Iraq as soon as conditions permit. And Jim McDermott, Democrat congressman from Washington State, along with six other Democrats, introduced a bill in Congress requiring that health and environmental effects be studied at sites where DU has been in use. What do you think? Is DU worth the potential risk? That's what we'll be talking about this hour. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website for more information. Let me introduce my guest this hour. Dr. Michael Kilpatrick is the Deputy Director of the Deployment Health Support Directorate of Health Affairs for the Department of Defense, and he joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Kilpatrick. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Dan Fahey is a Navy veteran. He served in the U.S. Navy from 1990 to 91, including service in the Persian Gulf in July of 91, and he graduated from the Navy's Tomahawk Cruise Missile School, the Phalanx Close-In Weapon Systems School, and Surface Warfare Officers School, among others. He served on the Board of Directors of the National Gulf War Resource Center from 1996 to 98. He currently serves on the Board of the Veterans for Common Sense. He's a contributing author to International Law on the Use of Depleted Uranium Munitions. That will be coming out this year. He lives in Berkeley. And he joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Fahey.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kilpatrick, let's talk about depleted uranium. How is it used? Where is it used?
Well, it's used as a munition, a penetrator for armor, by our M1A1 tanks, as well as by our A-10 airplanes and our Bradley fighting machines. The depleted uranium is essentially a metal rod that, for the M1A1 tanks, weighs about 9 pounds. It has a very long range of effectiveness at penetrating armor. In fact, it's superior to any other heavy metal. Mm-hmm. From the A-10 airplanes, we use a 30 millimeter, essentially metal rod that comes from a bullet shot by the airplane, and the Bradley fighting machines use a 25 millimeter piece of essentially this heavy metal. Mm-hmm. When it hits armor, it essentially self-sharpens as it goes through, and that self-sharpening does create an oxide that comes off, particles, and those do they're create essentially a fireball as they go through heavy armor. The DoD also uses depleted uranium as armor on the M1A1 heavy tanks. And again, this gives it superior protection against any other armor-penetrating munition that's shot. The other heavy metals that have been used in the past to penetrate armor are things like lead and steel, which really flatten when they hit armor. Tungsten doesn't flatten as much as lead, but it still mushrooms when it hits armor. So depleted uranium is the superior munition for penetrating armor.
So it vaporizes when it hits the tank.
Well, when it goes through, part of it does is it burns into the tank, part of it comes off. But anywhere in studies done from 20 to maybe 50% of it will turn to a dust. The rest ends up as either chunks of metal or an intact metal. If it does not hit armor, if it hits soft soil, for example, it will just bury in the soil. If it hits rock, for example, in a mountainous area or pavement, it could ricochet and end up lying on the surface. Mm.
Dan Fahey, let's talk about the possible health risks of DU, because I know you believe that there are health risks associated with depleted uranium.
Well, my belief stems from a plain reading of many of the Department of Defense's own reports. And in fact, there was a very interesting report from July of 1990 that the Army released just 6 months before Operation Desert Storm, in which they predicted that the use of depleted uranium munitions in combat would result in localized areas of contamination consisting of very fine respirable-sized dust, that this dust could be inhaled by not only combat soldiers, but after the conflict is over, by civilians. And they predicted that the resulting health effects could include cancer and kidney damage. And in fact, they went so far as to predict that once the public was aware of the health and environmental hazards posed by depleted uranium, that there would be a movement to ban it, and that the Army needed to proactively engage in a public relations effort to dampen public concern. So since the war, these concerns have been amplified, and the issue has tended to have gone to two polar extremes, where we're at the point now we have people making very extreme claims, claiming that this is similar to Chernobyl or its use constitutes genocide, which I believe are vastly exaggerated. But on the other hand, we do have the Pentagon overstating the importance of this for the arsenal while understating what they know to be at least the potential health and environmental risks. And we really haven't had an adequate study of either Gulf War veterans from 1991 or of civilian populations to draw any firm conclusions at this point about the health effects of depleted uranium.
You say there haven't been adequate studies, but Dr. Kilpatrick, every time you look at the Army literature, they cite a case history of 90 soldiers who were under a friendly fire during the first Gulf War and were exposed to depleted uranium, and it appears from these soldiers are not suffering any long-term effects, correct?
Well, this is a study that Dr. Melissa McDermott at the Baltimore VA Hospital has headed up, and this is a medical follow-up study. She is currently following some 70 of those individuals who were in or on armored vehicles that were struck by depleted uranium in friendly fire, in other words, U.S. on U.S. in the Gulf War. She has not found any health consequences related to the depleted uranium exposure that these individuals had. She's continuing to follow them, particularly the ones that have small fragments of depleted uranium still in their body. To remove them would require amputation or major surgery. Since they're not showing any untoward health effects, the idea is to follow them and not to undergo that surgery. But I think that it is important to understand that depleted uranium is a heavy metal, and like all heavy metals, we recognize there is a chemical toxicity, that if the dose inside one's body is high enough, there certainly can be damage to tissue, to cells. Then when you add to it the understanding that depleted uranium does have some radioactivity to it, it's 40% less than natural uranium, that is a concern that has prompted DOD to continue to fund some basic science studies as well as to follow humans who were exposed to depleted uranium.
Is there no cancer, lung cancer risk from inhaling radioactive particles?
Well, I think that there's a theoretical concern of that, because you're taking in a heavy metal as well as one that has some ability as a radioactive element to have alpha emitters. And theoretically, one alpha particle could cause a cancer.
Right.
The reality is, in looking at these individuals who were in or on vehicles and certainly inhaled the highest concentration of oxide, because the highest concentration is when it's penetrating an armored vehicle, that they are not showing any untoward effects. We're certainly looking at lungs very closely, looking at bone. Their kidneys have been followed very closely with non-invasive studies, in other words, not damaging the kidney by taking out samples, but by looking at beta-1 microglobulins. Those are early indicators of cellular damage in the collecting tubule. And in the individuals that have been followed, we're not seeing any changes in those markers.
Dan Fahey?
Well, the history of the VA's depleted uranium study is very interesting, and I've written about it recently in a report titled Science or Science Fiction, which is up on the web. But that study really has a lot of very serious problems with it. When it was established in 1993, the VA initially reached out to 35 veterans, and among those veterans were veterans who'd been wounded by depleted uranium in combat. Now, according to the Army's own regulations that were in place in 1991, any soldiers who had known or suspected exposures to depleted uranium were supposed to have received medical testing and monitoring. But even veterans who were wounded in combat by depleted uranium fragments during friendly fire incidents were not told that they had been wounded by depleted uranium or otherwise exposed. So when this program was established, only 35 veterans were put into it. And over the course of the next 5 years, the Department of Defense continued to tell they told five consecutive federal investigations of Gulf War veterans' illnesses that only 35 friendly fire vets had been exposed. And through documents that I obtained through the Freedom of Information Act, we forced the Pentagon to admit that, in fact, vastly more had been exposed than previously admitted. But Mike mentioned the cancer risks, and the Institute of Medicine has really identified three potential areas that are of concern. One is the lung, one is the bone, and the other are lymphatic cancers. And in fact, in 1999, one of the veterans that is included in the VA's study had lymphatic cancer. And it's very interesting to note that in the year 2001, when there was a very big controversy in Europe over the use of depleted uranium in the Balkans by the U.S. military, that Pentagon spokesman traveled to Europe and told at press conferences, the transcripts are available on the web, stated very clearly that there had been no cancers among any of the veterans in the U.S. study, when in fact we now know that that was essentially a lie. And there are other problems with the VA program, including that the Pentagon has identified about 900 veterans who were in units that had significant exposures to depleted uranium. Yet that 70 number, or Mike has also used the number 90 recently, is very misleading, because the last time the veterans were examined, only 39 were examined. And many of the 70 have not even been seen in 10 years. We have no idea what their health status is. So I have called for the VA to vastly increase their study and do a health survey of the 900 veterans that the Pentagon has identified as having significant depleted uranium exposures.
Dr. Kilpatrick, could it be possible that we're only 12 years after the first Gulf War, it might be too early to see any cancers that might be popping up?
Well, certainly, if you take a look at what you would expect to see historically for exposures that result in cancers, that you would expect this to be out anywhere from 15 to 30 years. So I think that any cancers that occur early, you would almost presume were not due to an exposure that occurred in the immediate preceding several years or maybe even 10 years. It certainly depends on dose of exposure. As we know from information from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as we looked at leukemias, that the peak of those was somewhere from 2 to 4 years after exposure to an atomic weapon. Now, depleted uranium is not an atomic weapon. It is a heavy metal that is less radioactive than natural uranium. We all ingest natural uranium. In fact, we take in about 500 to 900 micrograms a year and excrete some 1 to 2 micrograms in our urine every day. And everybody's body has somewhere in the range of 90 micrograms of natural uranium in the bone, other tissues in the body. So it is a heavy metal that is part of our environment and part of our exposures as humans.
Dr. Kilpatrick, Dan Fahey, stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break, and lots of people want to get in on the conversation. We'll go to the phone, so don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about depleted uranium as used in the war in Iraq and other places in the last 10, 15 years or so. My guests are Dan Fahey, a Navy veteran and veterans advocate for depleted uranium issues, Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, a deputy director of the Deployment Health Support Directorate, Health Affairs for the Department of Defense. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. What about the uranium that goes to the soil? If it's being vaporized or if it's becoming in dust, doesn't that remain in the soil and be left behind for people who might be coming later on to live there or be working in the area? Let me ask Dan Fahey and then Dr. Kilpatrick, you can react.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's a question that's on a lot of people's minds these days in the aftermath of the recent war in Iraq. But this issue has been studied extensively by the United Nations Environment Program, as you mentioned, but also by the British Royal Society and the World Health Organization. And all of those studies have called attention to the potential for use of depleted uranium to result in soil contamination that does pose a risk to human health. And in particular, what the World Health Organization and also other scientists, there was recently a depleted uranium issue in the Journal of Environmental Radioactivity, and they've in particular called to attention to the potential for children to be overexposed to depleted uranium when playing in soil. And there's certainly been many pictures that it came out of southern Iraq after the war, but also the Balkans, of children playing on contaminated tanks, or I should clarify that, on destroyed tanks that we don't know if they were contaminated or not. But the children don't know either. And that's what makes it particularly a concern right now, because the Pentagon has stated that not only will they not clean up any depleted uranium in Iraq, but they refuse to even study the issue and do basic environmental assessments and to warn the civilian populations and relief workers, which flies in the face of the recommendations made by the World Health Organization, the United Nations Environment Program, mm-hmm. and other credible international scientific organizations.
Dr. Kilpatrick.
Well, I think the studies that Dan Fahey quoted about the United Nations Environmental Program, in particular, the Department of Defense really did endorse and support those studies being done. I think that clearly the United Nations Environmental Program has already stated they're very interested in going into Iraq to take a look at environmental hazards, everything from sewage to contaminated water, to polluted water, to multiple other effects, including depleted uranium. I think that because depleted uranium is slightly radioactive, if there are armored vehicles that have been damaged with depleted uranium, it would be able to very easily identify the fact that they were, in fact, hit with depleted uranium. But those armored vehicles pose other threats besides depleted uranium. The munitions that may still be inside unexploded could be other contaminants from what's inside the vehicle itself. If they're Russian-made, the radium and dials that could have been broken present a large number of hazards. And certainly going into any post-combat zone, it's extremely important to identify what those hazards are to make sure that both military and civilian population avoid them. So I think that the rational approach to this, as the war is still skirmishes going on, looking at how do we protect the people of Iraq. That was the purpose of Operation Iraqi Freedom, is to free the people of Iraq, and that will carry on in making sure they are protected from any environmental hazards that are present or could be present in the future.
I've been reading the Department of Defense documents on how happy they are about the effectiveness of DU weaponry. It doesn't seem like there could be anything that would... any results of us, any really studies short of some catastrophic answers, which would make the DOD give up on these shells, saying basically they're saying, you know, this is war, war is hell, and we have to put up with this to maintain our superiority.
Well, they certainly are superior weapons for penetrating armor, but the Department of Defense is funding some very important basic science research looking at the effect of depleted uranium and other heavy metals, including tungsten and tungsten alloys, in tissue cultures and in animal models. While the results from these are not directly applicable to effects in human beings, they do have relevance. And I think that as we move forward in this, it's extremely important to understand what science can tell us. And I think that when we see some genotoxic effects in tissue cultures, or we see tumor development in laboratory animals, it does give one pause, but you need to have the scientific process go forward to take a look at what does this mean to an organism such as a human being that has multiple exposures to multiple different toxins throughout their lifetime.
Well, Mike, that's what makes it very confusing why the Department of Defense is refusing to even study this issue right now in Iraq because, as you just mentioned, there are the laboratory studies are very interesting and have also found the development of cancer in rats. And so I hope the Department of Defense will remove its resistance to allowing the United Nations Environment Program's post-conflict assessment unit to move into Iraq and do a rapid assessment not only of DU but of all of the environmental hazards.
Well, I as a Department of Defense individual who is focused on health, that certainly is the intention. You can't go in during a firefight's going on and put environmental assessors in harm's way. But that certainly needs to be one of the things that we do when the time is right. And I think that taking a statement that we're not going to be doing that today and trying to extrapolate that to the future is not appropriate.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two. And before we have to go, let's go to Melissa in New Hampshire. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. Thank you, Ira, for taking my call. I appreciate it. I have a bit of a question. First of all, for the man who is pro-veterans who have been in the Desert Storm, I didn't know if he might have some numbers or something that we can call to get help or information on some of the research and data he's come up with.
We'll have it on our website, so you can go right to Science Friday. We'll have the links to Dan Fahey's. It's easier than giving out a long string
right,
that you'll forget.
Okay, and my other one was basically a comment. One of my relatives, very close relatives, was over in Desert Storm in 91 for about a year or so. When he came back, he, in the general vicinity of where he lived, there were six other men who were in the same battalion that he was in. They were on the front lines going into Baghdad or surrounding Baghdad. And they were exposed, and they were also packing depleted uranium shells and exposed to tanks and such that had been hit with depleted uranium. And three of those guys came down with real radical forms of cancer. Two of them died. Now, when they tried to get help from the Veterans Administration, they were basically, to put it bluntly, blown off. They were kind of put to the side, and they were ignored, basically, up here in New Hampshire. The veterans here are treated very badly, and they were given one questionnaire to fill out about the whole possible depleted uranium and chemical exposure over there, and that's all they heard about it as far as military taking care of them. And it makes me incredibly angry because my relative was also over in Vietnam and exposed to Agent Orange, which they are continuing to say had no effects on the veterans over there at all. And so I'm just concerned for my relative.
Let me ask Dr. Kilpatrick if there's anything.
Well, certainly I think that when people first came back from the Gulf, neither the Department of Defense nor the Department of Veterans Affairs were prepared to start to conduct massive kinds of research or investigative studies. But the VA did in 1992 start doing comprehensive medical examinations on any Gulf War veteran who had any health concern or just wanted an examination. And the Department of Defense followed suit in 94, so there was a bit of a delay between the end of the war, people coming back, and these programs being started. And we certainly continue to work with veterans because many of them do have symptoms that are real, they're not imaginary, that are very debilitating, for which medical diagnosis cannot be made to explain those symptoms. I think when people have cancers, certainly that is of major concern. As we take a look at populations, we don't see differences in rates of cancers or types of cancers in those who deployed and those who don't. When you look at individuals, it's a totally different story, and we really work hard to make sure that those individuals get care from a physician who looks at that patient as an issue, a problem, a person that they need to take care of. And sometimes that doctor-patient relationship is broken down. My recommendation is always get another doctor if you're not able to communicate.
Well, the doctor is the government at the VA
exactly.
Hospital. Who are you going to go to?
The situation with my relative was the fact that they were mandated to report to get a checkup, and the doctors didn't do a decent checkup. They just, breathe in, breathe out, your lungs are working, that's fine, now go away. And that's essentially the type of veterans care up here that they've been getting after they got out of Desert Storm. And so if they're receiving this, how many other veterans are having to put up with the same type of behavior and treatment from the government and from the Veterans Administration, which is next to nothing? And some of these veterans do not have the extra income to where they can go to another doctor to get a second opinion.
Dan Fahey, do you sound familiar to you?
It sounds too familiar, unfortunately. I worked as a paralegal for many years helping veterans file disability claims, and it was through that work that I began my efforts on depleted uranium. But, you know, it is very confusing. If you look back at what happened after 1991, it's very clear that the Department of Defense, at least at the high levels, were aware that depleted uranium presented a hazard to the health of our troops, and that even in the weeks before Desert Storm started, messages were sent to Central Command in Riyadh saying, at a minimum, tell troops to stay away from any destroyed vehicles. But for reasons that the Department of Defense has never explained, those messages were never passed out on to the frontline troops, to the infantry soldiers and armor troops and artillery soldiers who were fighting. And as a result, many people were climbing all over vehicles. And that was partly what got me involved in this issue, was talking with hundreds of Gulf War veterans who were having health problems. And depleted uranium is not the only cause, and probably not even the major cause, of the illnesses that we've seen. There were many other exposure factors, but the fact is that depleted uranium was out there on the battlefield. It did present a hazard. Troops had no information about it. And then afterwards, the government was very reluctant to acknowledge that there were hazards, because it's very important, I can't emphasize enough, the political nature of this issue, that this issue, and in fact, the VA study has become very politicized as there's been growing international concern about our use of depleted uranium. The Pentagon has gone to great lengths to try and dampen the concerns by misrepresenting the findings of our own research, both laboratory animals and on veterans, and also in terms of overplaying the importance to try and justify to the American public that, well, this may cause health problems, and we don't need to clean it up in Iraq or the Balkans or elsewhere because it works well, and therefore the ends justifies the means. But right. I'll end there.
I want to see if I can get another call or two. Thank you for calling, Linda. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones, and let's go to Pete Zimmerman in Washington.
Hello, Iris.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. You know, as an old nuclear physicist, I'm listening to this, and I want to put some of it in perspective.
We don't have that much time, Pete. You're going to have to hurry.
I know that. Let me start out by saying that in my lab days, I used to use DU bricks as door stoppers, DU dust on them and all. So the health physics people at Fermi Lab, for example, don't think it's a terrible hazard. One really has to put this in perspective and remember that depleted uranium's half-life is that of the age of the Earth. So when you say it's radioactive, it's just barely radioactive.
So you have no problem with people inhaling the dust of it then?
Well, I have problems with people inhaling any heavy metal dust, because any heavy metal is going to have a heavy metal toxicity.
Oh, we're not talking about toxicity. We're talking about the radiation effects.
You know, I have much less worry about them inhaling the radioactive dust from uranium than I do from them getting the radiocarbon that's in the atmosphere, or any of the alpha sources that float around. I think that the amount of radiation that they're likely to get over the course of a lifetime of having a small particle embedded is really quite small from uranium as compared to, let's just say radon in the basement of your house. I think that's an enormously higher problem. But yes, I'd worry about the ground contamination, and yes, it should be cleaned up. But should we give up the munition? No.
All right, Pete, thanks for checking in with us. We're talking about depleted uranium this hour. Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dan, any reaction?
Well, he makes a very good point that I think sometimes people have focused in on the radioactive aspect of depleted uranium, when in fact the laboratory studies that have been done by the Armed Forces Radiobiology Research Institute have stated very clearly that the effects they've seen, which include cancer, DNA damage, cell death, are caused by the chemical toxicity alone. So whether it's the radioactivity or the chemical toxicity, to me, is not the central issue. Mm-hmm. The central issue is that depleted uranium in these laboratory studies has been shown to cause cancer, and therefore you know, I think the discussion over use it or not right at this moment is not the central issue. The central issue is that we've just used a large amount of this, apparently, in Iraq. Most of it has been shot into urban areas where there are large populations living. And earlier this week, the Department of Defense stated that they were refusing to study this issue. And I think that's really the front burner issue, is that we need to allow the United Nations Environment Program to move into Iraq as soon as possible and to conduct comprehensive environmental mm-hmm. studies that look at DU and other causative factors.
Dr. Kilpatrick, is that true that the DOD has refused to study this?
Well, I think that there has been a statement made by a spokesman that there is not a plan in place at this time. Now, there was a meeting just the other day that involved State Department and Department of Defense and United Nations Environmental Program on how to go about doing that study. And I think that the template that the United Nations Environmental Program has done in the Balkans is clearly an ideal template to use. And I think that's what you will see in the very near future. And so the Department of Defense is a very large organization. There are many people, and it's a matter of getting information from the people with the expertise to understand what the issue is. And I think the issue is one of concern. If there are projectiles lying on the ground, they should certainly be picked up. If there's unexploded ordnance on the ground, it should certainly be picked up. And I think that those are part of our responsibility to the people of Iraq.
Uh-huh. Any other thing, Dan, that you think should be done? We only about 30 seconds.
Well, I do think that we do need to do a comprehensive health study on the veterans from the 91 war and move away from this extremely small study focusing on a few veterans to include the people in the units the Pentagon has identified. In addition to that, we need to be doing assessments of the health of our troops who are in Iraq at the moment. And for people who may have been exposed to depleted uranium, I believe we need to establish a second depleted uranium study for mm-hmm. veterans of the second Gulf War to start looking at those troops, and not only U.S. troops, but British troops who also used depleted right. uranium in this right. conflict.
Thank you very much, both of you gentlemen. Dan Fahey, a Navy veteran and a veterans advocate for depleted uranium issues. Dr. Michael Kilpatrick, Deputy Director of the Deployment Health Support Directorate, Health Affairs for the Department of Defense. Thanks for joining us this hour. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about Iraq and the looting that went on there. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News.